This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by returning guest, author, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Chris Hedges.
We discuss a range of topics, including the impact of America's new oligarchy and fascistic Trump regime.
We talk with a nationally known expert on immigration rights and low-wage workers about Donald Trump's plan to deport millions of immigrants back to their home countries.
Attorney Victor Naro joins us. He's project director for the UCLA Labor Center and for the core faculty of the UCLA Department of Labor Studies.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Last month, Elon Musk said something about the Trump election with which we could all agree. He said, "This was no ordinary victory. This was a fork in the road of human civilization," end quote. Now our democracy, however restricted by class and race, is in the process of being replaced by a super wealthy oligarchy. There are over 800 billionaires in the USA. They're now in the saddle. The Citizens United Supreme Court case of 2010 eased the process. Trump was elected with money from 10 people, pretty much. Elon Musk alone contributed $27 million. That is over $250 million from one man to another man. Biden himself, in his farewell address, warned of the takeover by an oligarchy, echoing President Eisenhower's famous warning of a military-industrial complex. Biden talked about the, quote, tech-industrial complex. The second Trump administration will not be like the first. It won't be incoherent or chaotic. This has been guaranteed by the Heritage Foundation, who wrote a 920-page playbook for dismantling our democracy. The process has begun with Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords and calling for more drilling. Drill, baby, drill is his mantra. This is a race towards human extinction. On January 21st, he pulled out of the World Health Organization. The day he was sworn in, he pardoned some 1,500 people who had participated and even led the January 6th insurrection. This is a green light for fascist mobs who now feel they can get away with anything. The Democratic Party has greased the skids for this transition. It cannot be relied on for the defense of the American people. Biden and Harris, after accurately calling Trump a fascist in the last few weeks of the election period, then did an about-face, welcoming him to the White House, saying they would cooperate with him and praising his peaceful transition, a transition that Trump himself said that if he lost, he would not abide by. Today, we speak with Chris Hedges. His penetrating journalism has resulted in his being fired and deplatformed, starting from the New York Times, where he was the Middle East bureau chief and Pulitzer Prize winner, to the Real News Network, where he was fired because of his criticism of Biden and the Democratic Party. Chris Hedges is the author of many books and writes on Substack. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, in his farewell address 2 weeks ago, Biden warned of the dangers of an oligarchy ruling over us. But America's always had a ruling class. After all, George Washington, the father of our country, was the richest man in America in his time. Is rule by an oligarchy different?
Yes. So I looked at this election as really a contest between corporatists and oligarchs. And corporate capitalism is different from oligarchic capitalism. Corporate capitalism is about stability because it's about investments and often important trade deals. So investments are made in countries like China, Vietnam, Bangladesh, Mexico, wherever. Oftentimes it takes a long time, significant amount of time to turn a profit because you're producing. So you want that decorum, you want that stability of an Obama or a Biden or, you know, even a Bush, as limited as Bush was. Oligarchic capital is another animal. Oligarchy wants chaos. It wants, as Steve Bannon says, to destroy the administrative state because it is a pure form of rentier capitalism. What it does, and this is what Amazon does and Google, it sets up toll booths. And you have to go through those toll booths. It extracts revenue in order for people to have access to goods and services. So I wrote a book called America, The Farewell Tour. It opens in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Scranton at the time was facing bankruptcy, and it was selling off or had sold off its sewer system, its parking authority, its electrical system, everything to private equity firms that jacked up the prices and, of course, deteriorated the services. So that's what you're seeing. And this, the oligarchs won in this election. And that's why you're seeing a rapid attempt to deconstruct all of the mechanisms in the state, including the Department of Education calls to privatize the Postal Service, because that's how oligarchs make money. So that's what the battle was, and that you were correct in your introduction to point out the power of oligarchs within this new administration.
I wonder, Chris, if you could explain the origins, if you will, of this American oligarchy that Biden spoke of. Where does it come from? How long has it been around? How has it developed? What are its principal origins?
Well, that's one of the ironies, because it's essentially unfettered, unregulated corporate power that created the oligarchic class and triggered this war within capitalism. So, and slashing the tax codes, which was a bipartisan effort. So you had the wealthiest among us, the billionaire class, paid less and less in terms of taxes. They were able to create monopolies like the digital platform monopolies. They were able to amass, individuals were able to amass tremendous amounts of wealth like Musk, like Bezos, and others. And their interest conflicted with the corporatists. So yes, oligarchs have always been with us, but it's been a long time since oligarchs have essentially run the country. They always had outsized influence given their wealth and power. But now we're living under a pure oligarchy. And these people are working very hard to dismantle all of civic society. Everything is to become privatized. And they want instability, because the more instability, the more people have to pay for services, including security. So everything becomes a form of extraction. Everything becomes predatory.
Chris, please talk about the destruction of our American form of government. Bernie Sanders, in a recent WBAI interview, stated that the billionaires have taken over the media, the political process through huge donations, and the government. Billionaires like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, are they utilizing Trump to effect a restructuring of American society?
Yes. I mean, let's not let the Democrats get a pass. The Democrats have been full partners in this deconstruction of American society. Programs of austerity, deindustrialization under NAFTA was carried out by the Clinton administration, ripping down the firewalls between investment and commercial banks with revoking Glass-Steagall was a Clinton project. The destruction of our system of welfare, and 70% of the recipients under the old welfare system were children, was a Democratic project. The militarization of police, the huge expansion of our carceral system, that was all it was a bipartisan, but it was led by the Democrats. So the Democrats are complicit in all of this, but the Democrats remain primarily a creature of corporate America rather than oligarchic America. So the deterioration within the American democracy was certainly carried out by both parties, and that seizure of power by the billionaire class and by corporations, so that you've deformed all institutions, and you mentioned the media correctly. It's a very important point that Ralph Nader makes about how 4 decades ago, the media used to report on the grassroots organizations, unions, civic organizations, many of which Ralph founded and led to carry out environmental reforms and worker safety reforms. And then, because they began to cater increasingly to their advertisers, they erased coverage. And that crippled those movements. And you've seen especially with the rise of the internet, constriction of media entities like the New York Times. Their coverage on Gaza has been awful. It's been horrendous, including banning reporters from using words like, refugees and this kind of stuff, Palestine itself, in an internal memo that was leaked to The Intercept. So the all of the institutions that once protected and safeguarded democracy have become captive to corporate power, including, of course, universities. So you have these, in a coordinated effort, these universities have shut down free speech and dissent on college campuses from coast to coast to placate their billionaire donors and turn them into academic gulags. And that is, again, another projection of oligarchic and corporate power.
You know, Chris, at the end of the recent election cycle, Kamala Harris and other Democrats, referred to Trump as a fascist. But now they seem to have stopped this. Trump was welcomed into the White House. Biden said in his farewell address, quote, "I wish the incoming administration success," close quote. Does this not scare you? I mean, can we ever, and certainly now, rely on the Democrats to protect us from the fascistic, authoritarian rule that Trump is already demonstrating?
No, the Democrats, I think, are kind of a dead party, and they fused with the establishment wing of the Republican Party. That's why Harris was touting her endorsement by Dick Cheney, a war criminal who left office with a 13% approval rating. I mean, they're completely tone deaf, completely out of touch. She led a vapid, celebrity-filled, issueless campaign. And the Democrats, in their postmortems, continue to show that they are completely unplugged from the reality of most Americans. It's all about branding, or we should have done this, or Biden should have left earlier, without addressing the most crucial dislocation of the American working class, 30 million Americans in mass layoffs since 1996, which the Democrats were responsible for. So not only have they refusing to address the fundamental problem that has given rise to our form of American fascism, so the Democratic Party not only has failed to recognize the problem, but they've failed to address their own culpability in an attempt to rectify it.
Chris, as a consequence of the Israeli genocide perpetrated against the Palestinians, that body of international law, which had been created, crafted after World War II to prevent genocides like that in Gaza, it's been trashed, really, hasn't it, by Israel and the U.S.?
Yes, but, you know, that fealty to humanitarian and international law is more honored in the breach than the observance. Our projects in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, were no less savage than what is happening in Gaza. Certainly, to a degree, Gaza is smaller, and the saturation bombing is unlike anything we've probably seen since the destruction of Dresden or Hamburg. But we violated just the invasion itself of Iraq. It was a violation of international law. Preemptive war is a crime under post-Nuremberg laws. But I think the other issue is that we in the West have never really understood our long capacity for genocide, whether that's the German slaughter of the Herero, the Armenian genocide, the Bengal famine of 1943 that took 3 million lives, the dropping of nuclear bombs on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. All of these genocides, which were integral to understanding Western imperialism and Western colonialism, have either been minimized or whitewashed by Western politicians and historians, but they're integral to Western culture and are as integral to Western culture and Western imperialism as the Nazi Holocaust, because they all emanate from the same machine, the machine that's killing the Palestinians. And that was something that the Global South, countries like South Africa, understood and understand, but we don't. So, yes, I think the difference is now there's no pretense, because you saw an active effort by countries such as the United States to shut down the clamor by the vast majority of nations to impose the rule of law and to halt the genocide. And I think that what it is that the visage has kind of been stripped away. And that presages a very dangerous shift in global relations, especially with the climate crisis, mass migrations, the rise of failed states. I think many people in the global south probably correctly feel that as the world breaks down, this genocidal machine that we see in Gaza will become more and more familiar across the globe.
I just want to remind our listeners that this is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Attorney Jim Lafferty. You're listening to Law and Disorder, and we're speaking with Chris Hedges, our returning guest. Chris, please talk about the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. How do you view it?
Well, I covered the Middle East for 7 years. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. And Israel has a pattern that it always negotiates, that whether that's Camp David, Oslo, or any of the ceasefire agreements, it negotiates in phases. And its first phase, it will give it what it wants. And then it fails habitually to implement the subsequent phases, and certainly any phase that would lead to a just and equitable peace. And I suspect that's what we're seeing. I don't expect it to hold over the long term. Indeed, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has already said that he feels that he has every right to continue the war or the genocide. So, the Netanyahu government has already reneged on the principal agreement by saying that it won't withdraw from the Philadelphia corridor. This is the 8-mile strip of land that separates Gaza from Egypt. I think that it will break down. I think that we're already seeing this very cynical policy of, because Gaza's pretty effectively been destroyed, 1.9 million Palestinians are homeless, and those that, with the ceasefire have tried to return to where they lived have found mounds of rubble. There's no sanitation. Gaza's a wasteland of 40 million tons of rubble and debris. The UN has estimated, UNRWA has estimated that it will take 15 years to clear the rubble, which Israel is not about to permit. And of course, the Knesset on last Thursday enacted prohibition from UNRWA from conducting any activities within Israel's borders and makes it illegal for any Israeli official to have contact with UNRWA. This will accelerate the famine and malnutrition. You have numerous diseases. There's no clean water. So hepatitis A is rampant, respiratory ailments, scabies, and there's a lot of food poisoning from rancid food. There's no medical services. So you have 90% of the population living in makeshift tents in the open air or under these slabs of concrete because 9 in 10 homes have been destroyed. I think Israel's policy is clear. It will continue to orchestrate this humanitarian crisis. And then I think that we will see a resumption of armed attacks against the Palestinians. And the goal is essentially to offer the Palestinians of exile or death. And that's the plan, and the United States will back it, and that doesn't really matter whether it's Biden or Trump. They both have backed the genocide.
Chris, you wrote, among your books, you wrote a book documenting the collapse of liberals in the face of the growing neo-fascism in our country. And at a prayer meeting recently, as has been well reported now, of course, attended by President Trump on the day after the inauguration, we had an Episcopal Reverend, Marianne Budd, in a gentle and tactful way, looking directly at Trump and simply asking him to show some mercy to gay and transgendered people and immigrants who find themselves without proper papers and such. Trump responded a day later, though, that she was stupid, boring, a member of the hard left, he claims, and a hater. Do you think this presages a wider resistance to Trump or not?
Well, She didn't mention the genocide at all, number one. And she essentially pleaded with Trump to show mercy. That's pretty different from the great Old Testament prophets that thundered against injustice and the abuse of power. So I'm not quite as forgiving, especially because she did not raise the genocide. But of course, Trump is very thin-skinned. And even that provoked abuse towards her. But I didn't look at her words as particularly prophetic or powerful or willing to condemn the malignancy of U.S. Complicity in genocide. That, for me, is the most important moment of our age.
Chris, I truly understand what you're talking about. So what can be done to resist and fight back?
I think we have to step outside the political system, and we have to resort to all of those mechanisms that disrupt the machinery of power. Civil disobedience, strikes are key. Mass mobilization. I hope that at this point people are not going to put their faith in the Democratic Party as a viable mechanism against the rise of an American fascism, which is real. I mean, in that sense, the statements by the Democrats are not wrong. We have seen this, and you pointed it out in your introduction, the kind of turbocharged effort to dismantle bureaucracies and laws and anything that stands between the predatory power of the oligarchic class, or in any way curbs the predatory power of the oligarchic class. Of course, ideologically, the Trump administration is embracing even more fervently than they did figures like Mike Huckabee and others, the fascism of the Christian right, which becomes the ideological veneer for this pillage. So I think we have to regain the kind of militancy that saved us from fascism in the 1930s, or go back to the eve of World War I. That becomes a direct confrontation with the system itself and the abandonment of the belief that internally the system can reform itself.
Luigi Mangione has become a popular hero, a real Robin Hood, for whacking the insurance industry's leader in the back with a pistol that killed him. And I don't think that's a real good idea, and I know you don't. And I wondered why, if you could just explain why you don't think it's a good idea either.
Well, it's counterproductive. I don't think capitalists should be allowed anywhere near a healthcare system, and United Health is responsible for certainly thousands, if not tens of thousands of premature deaths. I have a little problem with, I certainly condemn the shooting, the assassination of the CEO of United Healthcare, but my real problem is that these figures of these for-profit healthcare companies are not held accountable for the many, many Americans they have consigned to death by either not providing coverage or delaying coverage, et cetera, not to mention all the bankruptcies they've caused. And so it just shows how kind of distorted the society is, where those who are responsible for murder and death on a large scale are not held to account. This poor kid is. But yes, that's not going to, that will make the power system more entrenched, more gated in a sense, that, and of course, all these CEOs then ran out for private security. That isn't going to bring them down, especially with these healthcare companies. You're seeing under the Trump administration a huge push to cut what little regulation they have left. I mean, the system is just appalling. We live in a nation where these corporations are legally empowered to hold sick children hostage while their parents bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters.
Yeah, indeed. You know, and the other thing is, I think it, like you said, it takes massive movements of the population to bring the system down, and it can't be done by just one person. and also puts the onus of violence on us rather than on them where it belongs. And the last thing I would think is that it just they put another person in that guy's place the next day. So it's really not very effective. Chris Hedges, how can our listeners follow your work?
Everything is on chrishedges.substack.com. And then there's a YouTube channel too, but everything comes out on the Substack.
You've got a new book coming out. What's it called?
It's on the genocide. It's called A Genocide Foretold. And it essentially looks at the antecedents for the genocide. I was also in the West Bank this summer, and then what it looks like on the ground. I wasn't in Gaza, but I was in the West Bank.
Well, we hope that you'll come back on Law and Disorder so we can talk about your book, Chris. And Jim and I thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Well, it's begun. Trump's plan to deport millions of immigrants back to their home countries, or if need be elsewhere, began in earnest in Chicago last week and in other places as well. A relatively small number have been rounded up each day, including a few U.S. citizens. I guess they just don't look American enough to escape an initial arrest. However, an even larger number of immigrants left voluntarily, too frightened to stay. Chicago, being a sanctuary city, its local policing officials refused to help in the roundups and expulsions. That, of course, brought threats from the Trump administration that they and any others in the country who did not fully cooperate with federal ICE officials and the local police during such raids might be prosecuted. Trump's been in office a little over a week, and already he's adopted the habit of threatening legal action against any and all who oppose him in any way. Of course, Trump and his loyal sycophants were quick to take to the airwaves in defense of the roundup with their bogus charges that, well, immigrants are criminals and they're taking jobs from real Americans, etc., etc. Never mind that the crime rate for undocumented immigrants is actually much lower than for us real Americans, and that the vast majority of the jobs they do are, well, mainly jobs most Americans simply will not do. So to review the new deportation plans of the Trump administration, its methods of operation, its likely costs, its likely success rate, and the threats of prosecuting anyone who interferes with the effort, or in the case of local officials, won't even cooperate with it, we are pleased to have with us today a leading expert on all matters having to do with the plight of immigrants in America and with the new effort to deport millions of them. He is attorney Victor Narro. Mr. Narro is a nationally known expert on immigrant rights and low-wage workers and has been involved in these efforts, well, for over 40 years now. He is currently a project director for the UCLA Labor Center and core faculty for the UCLA Department of Labor Studies, where he teaches classes that focus on immigrant rights, social justice, and the labor movement. And Victor Narro is also core faculty for the Public Interest Law Program at UCLA School of Law. Victor Narro's latest book is The Activist Spirit, Towards a Radical Solidarity, published by Hardball Press. Well, Victor Narro, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you so much, Jim. So great to be on this program.
Well, Victor, as we know, one of Trump's biggest and most effective, I would argue, campaign promises was that if he was elected, he was going to immediately undertake to round up and deport millions, sometimes he said 11 million, to use his words of these illegal aliens, who he refers to, of course, as murderers, and drug smugglers and rapists and what have you. Those worthless people, you know, those people who receive, he claims, far more from America than they're giving back to America. So before we get into his current program and what has already started, remind our listeners who, in fact, the vast majority of immigrants in our country really are. What is their crime rate, for example? Do they get more from America than they contribute back, cost-wise and so forth? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, first of all, Jim, you know, this is Trump 2.0. So we went through all this, his attack on immigrants and immigrant communities from 2016 to 2020 during Trump 1.0. And so we were ready for this. And, you know, we were preparing for this moment because we knew he was coming hard after immigrants. And immigrant communities are everywhere in this country. It's the demographic of our country has changed dramatically. And immigrants are, I think, have become a main part of our social and economic fabric of our country. And Trump is trying to tear that apart. Data after data reports have shown that the crime, immigrant communities, especially undocumented immigrant, really commit crimes. I mean, there are crimes committed, you know, they do commit, no different than the population of U.S. born citizens commit crimes as well. But when you compare it, the data, the crime rate for immigrants in this country, especially undocumented immigrants, is much lower than the crime rate for other groups. And I think that there's a lot of misinformation. He's throwing terminology about us all being murderers, gang members, drug smugglers, rapists. These are fear tactics, and this is misinformation that we just need to counter and provide different kinds of data. I focus on, in my work at the Labor Center, I focus on research on the economy, especially research when it relates to immigrant workers. And, you know, here in California, for example, we're the fifth largest economy in the whole world. I mean, we have really subsidized the entire country, the California economy. A big part of the workforce in California is immigrant workers. There are industries like agriculture with the majority of workers are immigrant workers, mostly undocumented workers. They fuel the economy. They give vibrancy to the economy. We have such great economic productions, not just because of immigrant workers, but immigrants themselves have purchasing power. When they, you know, when they make wages and they have an income, they become our major consumers. They contribute to the economy, not just as workers, but as big part of our consumer base. And I think that we need to start promoting the contributions, because I think that's another attack from the Trump administration, that we're taking away jobs, that we are a drain on the economy. We get benefits, even though undocumented immigrants don't qualify for any benefits. So I don't know what benefits he's referring to. But there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of misleading information that we need to be doing the counterattack and changing the narrative.
Victor, please remind us how Trump's massive deportation plan is supposed to work. Does it make a distinction between categories of immigrants, you know, those who are here on special visas or the DACA students whose parents brought them to America when they were very young, or those without documentation and working on farms and fast food restaurants and our hospitals? Does Trump's plan really take into account the fact that there are a number of different categories of undocumented workers and partially documented workers here in America today?
Well, he's vowed to have the greatest deportation plan of all in history. I mean, he bases his from the Eisenhower administration, the foundation of Operation Wetback, when they did a huge deportation process. But many U.S. citizens, many legal people with legal status were deported under that process. So they stopped that deportation process, that deportation program immediately. But he claims he has the ability and the resources to engage in the largest deportation ever. Tom Holman, his immigration, his border czar, is kind of leading this effort, leading the narrative. They have made it clear that they're, you know, now prioritizing people with serious, been convicted of serious crime. But he, you know, a few days ago went on the air to make it known that anybody will be subject to his, the deportation plan. they're using the concept of collateral arrest. Under, you know, back in 2011, under Obama, and then Biden also kept this policy. You know, ICE, Immigration Enforcement, Homeland Security agree that they will engage in targeted enforcement, which means they go after a particular individual, but not anybody else in the surrounding areas. As we've seen in Chicago, what happened recently, they've made it clear that if ICE enforcement is happening in a particular area and they're going after a certain individual, they are also free to question anybody, to detain anybody in that particular neighborhood, a particular vicinity, which just means like anybody can get caught. And this is why like U.S. citizens were arrested recently. This is why people with legal status were arrested and detained, because they are using collateral arrest as the hallmark. And then they've also made it clear that they're not going to respect the longstanding policy of staying away from schools, health clinics, churches, these areas where, you know, they've always historically stayed away from. They made it clear that they're going to go into the schools, they're going to go into churches, they're going to go into health clinics. So they're dismantling, they're eradicating all the agreements of the past of how they were going to confine immigration enforcement. Anybody's a target. Basically, what they've been doing is, if you have brown skin, you're going to be targeted. You can be questioned. You can be detained. Even though their enforcement operation may be going after particular individuals, they've made it clear they're going to target anybody within their sight.
Victor, there are tens of thousands of immigrants in the country today who came here from very dangerous, dire situations in their home country. And they've come here and they've applied for asylum in America, which under international law, they have every right to do. So how does the Trump plan intend to treat that group of immigrants, that large group who are here seeking, as they have every right to do, political asylum? How is it that category of immigrants, which is going to keep growing, will be the effect of that on the Trump plans?
One of the things that they don't like political asylum. I mean, one of his major attacks has been, he claims political asylum has been a fallacy. Like he connects political asylum with open borders. And his claim is that it's been an abuse of the political asylum system. He's making the same reference to like temporary protected status and other, other kinds of immediate, deferred action relief for immigrants. And he wants to get rid of it all. And he wants to restrict asylum status. He claims that our version of political asylum, the Democrats have connected it with open borders. We're going to continue. I mean, there's a lot of, one of the fight back is there are a lot of asylum petitions where, immigration lawyers and immigrant rights organizations are going to continue to fight for the rights of people here under asylum petitions. The issue there, the concern I have is that the Department of Justice regulate the administrative process of immigration proceedings. They control the judges. They oversee that process because it's not, it's within, under the purview of the Department of Justice, and they can change the metrics, which I think that's something that they're going to be doing soon if they haven't, is changing the metrics that the immigration judges use to determine outcomes of asylum cases. They, in essence, going to pressure immigration judges to grant more deportations. And so under the asylum process, you have the right to appeal. And I think we're going to continue the fight to make sure within the legal system to fight as much as possible for people here under asylum petitions. The bigger crisis is when people try to seek asylum, because they are, in essence, just restricting the borders so severely that it's almost impossible to seek asylum. So we need to figure out that fight. We need to use international law. We need to just use anything we can to push back on their attempts to really eradicate the future prices of seeking asylum.
The vast majority of undocumented immigrants that Trump intends to round up and deport are people of color. They're from Central America and South America. Is it your contention that America's efforts to deport them by the millions is, at least in part, racist?
I think the answer to that is a strong yes. But, keep in mind, this is a repeat of what he did in 2016, 2017, when he was targeting groups from different countries, creating ban, travel bans, like the Muslim ban. It was one example. He targets specific groups from different countries and labels them as terrorists, as a threat to democracy, as a national security threat. But it's all racist motivated by strong, deep level of racism. And we should just call it out for what it is, you know. And, you know, Stephen Miller, his cabinet, you know, they're all racist. And they have strong racist feelings against certain groups. And I have no qualms of calling it out for what it is, you know.
Victor, I wonder just how realistic it is. Trump is famous for being a boaster, but how realistic it is that Trump will be able actually to create a program of roundups and deportations that will add up to millions of undocumented immigrants being deported. What are the costs involved in such a program? The cost for detention centers, more military at our border, more immigration judges. The cost of all that, I'm wondering, do you'd like to comment on? And even if he received all of the money he claims to need for such a massive enterprise, is he likely to succeed in deporting the numbers of immigrants he claims he'll be able to remove? And finally, what role does fear of detection on the part of undocumented immigrants have on the success of Trump's plans? I mean, I would note, and I think you paid reference to this already, that last week it's estimated that while small numbers were apprehended by ICE, several times as many are believed to have voluntarily left the country out of fear. So talk to us about the chances of Trump really being able to get the money needed to do all the deportations he's talked about and this other effect of fear.
There's a lot of analysis out there that how much it's going to cost and everything, but my main concern is he's shifting the entire federal government enforcement regime in this direction. He's already got, FBI, drug enforcement, U.S. Marshals, all the federal agencies that do enforcement working on this immigration policy. He's instructed the Department of Justice to instruct the U.S. attorney's offices throughout the country to prioritize immigration enforcement over other crimes. So he's shifting all the federal government agencies in that direction. If we continue to organize, because what happened in Chicago is very important. They didn't have the outcome. They didn't get the outcome they anticipated. So there was a lot of frustration. Tom Homan on, CNN was frustrated at how well-educated immigrant community members were in Chicago about not participating, not cooperating. And he's upset with the immigrant rights groups, with all the social justice groups for educating community members about their rights. He claims now we're interfering with law enforcement. So I think it shows the power that we have. We're doing it in Los Angeles. We're doing it in other cities throughout the country. We're working together. We're like, everybody's as much as possible is being educated about their rights, because that's the first part of the battle. Then the second part of the battle is what we do when they do show up. You know, and it goes beyond just creating strong sanctuary policies. It's what do we do on the streets? But the first part of it, educating as many community members as possible, I think we're winning that. We just got to keep it up. We just got to keep educating immigrant households, immigrant families. One thing I failed to mention in the past, you know, this is not just an issue of deporting undocumented immigrants. What happens in this country, data have shown statistics, is immigrant families in this country are mixed households. They have, which means that you have either U.S.-born citizens or legal permanent resident citizens in the same household as undocumented students. A lot of my students at UCLA who are undocumented students, they come from mixed households. They have one parent might be a U.S. citizen and the other parent who may not be, documented. And so we need to keep in mind this is story. It's not just the issue of deporting undocumented immigrants. It's you're destroying immigrant families. You're destroying this whole community of immigrant communities and families throughout the whole country, and that has an impact on them as well. But the more we involve community members, the more we involve families in the resistance, getting to know their rights, but also fighting back, you're gonna see the same outcome in Chicago, where they go in expecting thousands of arrests and only coming out with a few number, a handful of number. And now they're threatening to go after the groups. They're threatening to go after, you know, social justice groups, immigrant rights groups, people like us for educating community members about their rights. So I think the more we keep the resistance and keep working together and being solidarity, that's going to really determine, I think, the success of the outcome of his immigration deportation plan.
I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with immigration attorney and teacher at the University of California in Los Angeles, Attorney Victor Nero. Victor, let's talk more about what happened in Chicago. Last week, when ICE and other federal law enforcement officials were in Chicago rounding up immigrants for deportation, police officials refused to join them in their efforts. After federal officials threatened to prosecute the local policing officials for their non-cooperation, the Trump administration now says it's got a right to prosecute anyone who stands in the way in connection with its deportation efforts. Talk to us, please, about this. Hasn't it always been illegal to actively interfere with ICE agents coming into a city to round up and deport immigrants? But can the federal government actually prosecute local law enforcement officials who simply stand aside and do no more than refuse to work actively with ICE to identify and round up immigrants for deportation?
Federal immigration law enforcement is a federal issue. And they, you know, we are not interfering with ICE and other federal agencies to be able to come in and do their operations and their enforcement. What we're saying is we're not required by law to participate in that. What we're saying is we're refusing to cooperate. We don't want to cooperate. We don't want to share information. This is the concept, the strength of sanctuary policies. And then when we're educating community members, we're not interfering. Like if I'm educating a group of community members, I'm not interfering with, we know ICE is going to be coming. We know federal immigration enforcement is going to do the enforcement operations. We're educating members of the community about their rights, their constitutional rights to be silent, their constitutional rights not to cooperate, not to answer questions. I don't know where that's illegal. You know, I don't see any reason, way that can be illegal, which is educating about rights they have under the law. We're not physically keeping federal law enforcement officers from entering into the city or entering into public spaces. They can go into any public spaces they want. But they're not going to have any cooperation from the community, any cooperation from groups, any cooperation from police or city departments. They're on their own, but we're not going to physically interfere with their operations. We're just telling them, we're standbys. You're on your own. You're going to have to do the work by yourself.
And in terms, Victor, in terms of what you mentioned, the immigrant rights groups that I assume are already organizing, already training, you're already talking about how the information on the rights of American citizens to protest in the streets over what ICE and what the Trump administration is doing are already underway. You make the point that so long as those demonstrations are not interfering actually with the work of these ICE agents, they're perfectly legal, even though Trump has said that he intends to, you know, even prosecute citizens who somehow are even demonstrating. He's even made an offhanded comment about that. The legality of that, though, is more than in question. It would seem as though it's clearly illegal. Do you anticipate, nevertheless, that there will be CD, civil disobedience actions, that the communities in places like Los Angeles, where, in fact, the majority of people in Los Angeles are immigrants or have immigrant heritage and immigrant past, do you suspect that the Trump administration will nevertheless try in those instances to actually go after organizations that are engaged in what we would normally think of as perfectly lawful First Amendment protest?
Well, they're going to try to go after organizations. We know it's coming. This is where solidarity helps. Like if they go after a specific immigrant rights organization because they're doing an effective job of fighting back of community outreach and resistance, they're going to probably target those groups. We need to be there. Like if they target one group, they target all of us. This is where we really need to be strong in community and solidarity with each other. But what happens on the streets, you know, it's different layers of strategies, right? We have rapid response networks set up. So when ICE agents do show up in a particular area, we can all mobilize and show up there quickly. You can be in public streets protesting. We see Jim on the street, like, you don't just get in the way of immigration enforcement officers when they're doing an operation, but you can be close enough to protest loudly. You can record in public. We can even get the media out there. We can put that kind of pressure on them. And then the next layer, of course, is the conscious decision to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience, which there's already movements happening where people are signing up, pledge of resistance. You know, it's similar to what we've seen in prior crisis when we address an issue that has such a large impact on community members that we sign our own pledge of resistance to engage in civil disobedience. And then when the arrests do happen, when we do get detained and arrested, then we have to fight it within the legal system. But that's the process of nonviolence, is to create that crisis for them. And I think that many of us are going to be engaging in that as well. The Trump administration doesn't believe in the First and Fourth Amendment. Anybody who denounces this policy is in violation of something. It could be, you know, putting something, a message out there he disagrees with, it's a violation. If you're on the streets protesting, addressing an issue, or even responding to one of his immigration operations on the streets with a protest, that's a violation. So anything that we do proactively is going to be a violation. Trump has a total lack of disregard for the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. But, you know, we're going to continue. We're going to continue fighting. We know the risk involved, but there's so much is at stake. So much is at stake. If we lose this issue of immigration, because his stuff is not only focused on immigration. He's going after the labor movement. He's going to go after not just workers, but the entire labor movement. There's so much at risk right now, not just with immigrant rights, but with workers' rights, environmental justice, that we all need to engage in this fight together and fight back strong.
Yeah, Victor, before we ask to tell our listeners how people can get a hold of you and follow your work, I wanted to ask you a couple of things. One is the Trump administration has raised the idea of quotas, like 1,500 people a day they want to pick up. And also, they've said they want to start sending people to Guantanamo Bay, the famous torture prison that the United States runs in Cuba. Can you comment on the quota question and Gitmo, please?
Yeah, the Trump administration is going to go after anybody. You know, it's just not one particular group of immigrants. It's going to go after anybody can get their hands on. He needs numbers. And I think, you know, to satisfy himself and his supporters, he needs to show numbers. And he's going to do anything he can to increase the numbers. And, you know, if you round up U.S. citizens and detain them, he's going to count those as numbers. He's, you know, you use military cargo planes. He uses that as numbers. Like, we don't know how filled they are, but he's going to claim they're filled up with a huge number of immigrants. Guantanamo Bay, my hope is we can put forth legal challenges to what he wants to do, but that's 30,000 he's talking about. He's going to boast that he's going to house 30,000 immigrants there. He's already using the numbers before it even happened. So I think with him, it's all about numbers, rhetoric, but there is a reality that he is trying very hard to come through with his promises. We need to pace ourselves. You know, we're only 9 days into his administration, or, you know, less than 2 weeks. We need to pace ourselves too, and not so much, you know, be drained by his rhetoric and his social media posts, but we just need to be more strategic and focusing on the actions, the stuff that he's doing, and the operations and everything. And I think that way we can pace ourselves, because we got 4 years of this coming up, so we need to figure out the sustainability. Like, the best thing to reach out to me is, if you go to the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights has the Rapid Response Network. You could go to their website. There's so many websites, to go through in California. Look at the immigrant rights groups. Find out who's, there are great immigrant rights groups and social justice groups leading this effort in many different cities. My role has been more in Los Angeles because that's where I'm located. But throughout the country, you know, the National Employment Law Center is doing, also information about the workplace, and the labor movement now is starting to become more concerned about ICE actions in the workplace. So there's many different ways for people to get connected. The issue is not to be alone. You see community members or other organizations feel like they're alone in this. Connect them. We just need to be connected to the vast networks of resistance that's taking place right now.
Thank you so much for being with us today here on Law and Disorder. That's good advice you've given. And we thank you so much for your appearance here today.
Thank you so much, and let's continue to struggle together.
You have our complete solidarity, Victor. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
Thank you.